of a perpetrator had to involve a properly arranged photo lineup. There needed to be a minimum of 6 pictures, all of people similar in size, appearance, and coloring. Even the setting had to be the same. You couldn't show, say, 5 portraits and 1 candid. The case law governing the subject had generated enough paperwork to fell entire forests. The Supreme Court typically revisited the topic every few years for one reason or another, killing off another few hundred trees in the process. The Attorney General's advisory on the subject ran for many pages and was constantly being updated. It would take time to create a proper mug book. Time Amy could no longer tolerate wasting. Without giving it further thought, she printed out 5 more Warren Plotts Facebook photos. She tucked them in a folder with the first one, then made the short drive back to Augusta Health. She paused at the door to Lily's room in case she was sleeping, but the young woman was sitting up, almost like she was expecting company. "Hello," she said. "Hi, Lily. How are you? Still tired?" "I've got a photo ID book for you to look at. You think you can handle that?" Lily nodded. "I'm going to show these to you one by one," Amy said. "Take as much time as you need. The man might not be in here. If he's not, no big deal, okay? Just do your best." Amy handed the first photo to Lily, who looked at it for 10 seconds or so, then placed it face down on the bed in front of her and gestured for the next one. After the third, she said, These are all the same guy, aren't they?"
"No,"
Amy said firmly. "They're not." 3 years of law school. 14 years of prosecuting hundreds of cases in Fairfax. 3 years and hundreds more in Stanton. Never once had she knowingly broken the law. And now she was doing it without so much as a hitch in her voice. Lily returned her attention to the photos. She made it all the way through, then went back to 2 of the ones in the middle. She studied them a little more, then selected the 4th one.
"This could be him," she said. "It looks more like him than any of the other ones do."
"Okay, thanks," Amy said. The witness positively identified the suspect from a sequential photo lineup. Amy was already writing the charging documents in her mind. She would get the warrant issued within 2 hours. She could fix the mug book later. By the time it went to Warren Plotts' lawyer, it would little resemble what Lily Pritchett had just thumbed through. To hell with the Supreme Court. Chapter 29. It's difficult to describe what it's like to sit there in a court of law and have respectable, rational, upstanding people scrutinizing you like you're the kind of mother who lets her 3-month-old baby roll around in cocaine. The clerk's face had this dour, downward cast, like she was offended to be breathing the same air as me. The bailiff was staring at me with open contempt. He couldn't wait to get home and tell his wife about the human cockroach who crawled into his courtroom. Judge Stone, who stopped just short of kicking me out of his courtroom after my outburst, kept giving me sideways glances. I wasn't merely one of those women who couldn't control their impulses anymore. I was maleficence personified. Beyond that, there were my concerns for Alex's health. Were those trace amounts of cocaine on him, or had he really gotten enough on him to ingest it? If he did, what kind of long-term consequences would that have? Most of all, what kind of cretin would knowingly endanger an infant like that? And what else would a person like that be willing to do? With those thoughts occupying me, I passed through the remainder of Tina Anderson's testimony in a haze. I only refocused when Nancy Dement and her epaulettes came to the witness stand.
In that jowly voice of hers, she went through the same routine of establishing herself and her credentials for the court. Then Donna Fell began solving the riddle of Dement's presence. "Ms. Dement, can you please tell the court how Miss Barrick and her child first came to your attention?" Fell asked.
"Ms. Anderson asked me to consult on the case," Dement said. "She told me she had received a call from Lieutenant Peter Kemp of the Augusta County Sheriff's Office, and she wanted me to talk to Lieutenant Kemp about a certain aspect of the case."
"And what did you and Lieutenant Kemp discuss?" Fell asked, in that way that made it clear she already knew the answer.
"He told me he had been working with a confidential informant relating to the criminal case against Ms. Barrick, and that the confidential informant had shared information with the sheriff's office that might be of interest to us."
"And what was that information?"
"The confidential informant told Lieutenant Kemp that Ms. Barrick wanted to sell her baby."
"Sell her baby?"
Judge Stone boomed. The charge, the mere suggestion of it, affronted him so greatly he leaned away from Dement. Then he rotated his whole body toward me. He could scarcely make his disgust more plain. At least for the moment, I didn't care. I was more focused on the revelation itself. This was what Dement refused to tell me in her office the previous week. I now at least had some inkling as to where this horrible accusation had come from, even if all it did was open up yet another mystery. Who was this confidential informant? As much as I wanted to think it was an invention of Nancy Dement's imagination, that couldn't be the case. She wouldn't rope a sheriff's lieutenant into a fiction like that. It had to be a real person saying made-up things. I began talking to Mr. Honeywell in a low, urgent voice. "That's not true. It's not true. I don't know who this confidential informant is, but he's lying. I never told anyone I wanted to sell my baby." Donna Fell had waited a beat for the judge to contain his shock, then continued, "And how did you respond to that?"
"I was taken aback, just like anyone would be," Dement said. "As I said, I have been working at this agency for 33 years, and I have never been confronted with a situation like this."
"What did you do next?"
"I asked Lieutenant Kemp for more details, and he couldn't really give me any. I think Lieutenant Kemp was more concerned with Ms. Barrick selling drugs and was going to leave the selling of the baby to us. I told Lieutenant Kemp I needed more information, and I asked if I could talk to the confidential informant myself."
"How did Lieutenant Kemp respond?"
"He was hesitant. He told me how the sheriff's office has to protect the identity of its informants. And of course, I understand that. He asked if perhaps he could relay some of my questions to the confidential informant and then get back to me with answers. I told him that given the nature of the issue, I really needed to talk with the informant myself. We went back and forth on this subject until we decided Lieutenant Kemp would bring the informant into his office and have the informant make the call from there." At this point, Mr. Honeywell stood up with more force than I knew him to be capable of, and for the first time since he had come into my life, he started acting like he was defending an innocent woman.
"Your Honor, I have to object. It sounds like Ms. Fell is about to have Ms. Dement recall the details of a conversation this confidential informant is alleging he had with Ms. Barrick. I realize Ms. Barrick is a party opponent, so her utterances are a hearsay exception. But what Ms. Fell is asking you to accept is clearly hearsay within hearsay. If Social Services wants you to consider what this confidential informant has to say about a conversation with Ms. Barrick, let's bring him in and get him under oath. Otherwise, I don't see how the court can allow Ms. Dement to bring this conversation into evidence."
I didn't know what had gotten into him, but when he was through, I felt like standing up and applauding him, or maybe like kissing his pudgy, wrinkled cheek. Someone who actually mattered, was finally sticking up for me. Better yet, Judge Stone seemed to be pondering my lawyer's argument.
"Miss Fell," he said, "what do you have to say about this?"
The plaintiff's lawyer straightened, making herself even taller. "Your Honor, I'd love nothing more than to bring this confidential informant in and have him testify. That's just not possible under the circumstances. But I think what this informant has to add to this case can't be ignored, and there's no other way to get it on the record. I'd ask that you remember the courts have long recognized the role of confidential informants in enforcing our laws, particularly our drug laws. We trust sworn law enforcement officers to make sound judgments about the reliability of their informants, and it seems reasonable the court have that kind of trust in Lieutenant Kemp. This isn't just someone Lieutenant Kemp picked up off the street. This is someone Lieutenant Kemp had used in other cases and considered to be solid." The judge turned back our way.
"Mr. Honeywell?"
"Judge, the courts have recognized the importance of confidential informants in criminal matters. This isn't criminal. It's civil. And in any court, it's still hearsay within hearsay. I'd ask you to disregard Miss Dement's testimony entirely. We're talking about basic due process here."
Judge Stone tented his fingers, a gesture that made him look very judicial indeed. The courtroom fell silent. I can't say I comprehended the legal underpinnings of the verbal melee that had just occurred. Hearsay rules weren't something they taught in my literature classes, but I certainly understood the consequences of what the judge was about to say. It would essentially decide whether or not I'd get to see my son while this case dragged out. If Nancy Dement's testimony was tossed, taking the absurdist fiction this confidential informant was spouting along with it, social services would have no basis to deny me supervised visits. I had this brief fantasy about being able to hold Alex again, about his soft little head resting against my cheek, about his warm, chunky body pressing against mine. I felt that loss like a phantom pain. Judge Stone shifted his weight in his seat, then crossed his arms as he gazed toward the back of the room. Then he looked at Mr. Honeywell and uttered a sentence that broke my heart.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Honeywell, but I'm going to have to overrule your objection," he said. "If this were a jury trial, I'd side with you all the way. But as you know, the law recognizes that a judge can assess evidence like this in a more nuanced way and assign it the proper weight. At the end of the day, I have to decide what's in the best interest of this child, and I need to use all evidence at my disposal to make that determination. You have my assurances that I'll take the hearsay factor into consideration. With that caveat, I'll allow it."
Mr. Honeywell sat back down. He didn't look at me. Maybe he didn't realize how devastated I was. Or maybe he knew precisely. Fell just picked up where she left off. "So, Miss Dement, you accepted Lieutenant Kemp's offer to talk with the confidential informant?"
"Yes."
"And when did this phone call occur?"
"Later that same day.
The informant called and confirmed that Miss Barrick had asked him whether he knew someone who might be interested in buying a baby. The informant was mindful that he had to keep up the facade of having criminal contacts, so he told her he could look into it. Miss Barrick told him she wanted a minimum of $50,000. When she uttered the amount, Judge Stone's eyes darted toward me and narrowed. In that moment, I knew I could completely disregard all his judge double talk about what weight he would give certain evidence. As Nancy Dement finished, the judge clearly had decided which way he fell on the subject of Melanie Ann Barrick. My own testimony, during which time Mr. Honeywell attempted to rehabilitate the tattered remains of my credibility, only did so much good. Judge Stone spoke like a man with bile on his tongue as he rattled off his various proclamations and decisions. He started with a preliminary removal order, confirming the emergency removal order he had given the previous week. He told me I needed to get a job and stay out of prison if I wanted to have any hope of convincing him I could provide a fit home for Alex. He finished by issuing a protective order against me, saying I couldn't knowingly come within 500 feet of Alex, wasn't allowed to make attempts to find him, and couldn't communicate with the foster family that had custody of him. My jaw was as unhinged as the rest of me, and I'm pretty sure it hung down the entire time. Because, sure, I could tell myself that I was being framed, that this was the work of hidden hands masterfully manipulating the levers of justice for their own purpose, and that therefore none of this reflected objective reality. But the fact was, the law, very real and very enforceable, with all the king's horses and all the king's men behind it, had just spoken. And it said I was the kind of mother whose child needed to be protected from her. Chapter 30. I was so defeated and dazed by the time I left the courtroom. I felt like someone had spent the past 2 hours beating on me with a bag full of padlocks. Needing to put some distance between myself and that awful courtroom, with its stale air and its preposterous accusations, I emptied out onto the street, setting a furious pace toward my car. For a moment, I thought I heard someone saying my name, but then I dismissed it. No one out here was looking for me. Then it came again. "Miss Barrick! Miss Barrick!" I turned to see Mr. Honeywell. He had followed me out of the courtroom. "Slow down," he said. I don't want to talk," I said in his direction, then quickened my pace. "You left your purse," he said. He was waving it in the air as he came toward me in the speediest limp he could manage. "Hold up," he said. "I'm an old man. My days of running around after young women are long gone." I walked back in his direction, feeling churlish for having made him chase me. "Thank you," I said when he handed me my purse. "I really appreciate it." I turned to continue toward my car, but Mr. Honeywell wasn't having it.
"Now, hang on a second. Just hang on," he said, out of breath. "I want to talk for a moment."
"What's there to talk about?" I said petulantly, then pointed toward the courthouse. "That man hates me, and he's clearly never going to let me have my son back."
"Now, now. Judge Stone is just, well, this is your first time in front of him, so he wants to set a certain tone. Some women, they don't take this as seriously as they need to, so he goes a little rough on them at first."
"A little rough," I said.
"Miss Barrick," he said,
still panting a little. Then he surprised me.
"Would you sit with me, please?"
He pointed to a stone bench that was under a tree in front of the courthouse. Sure, I said. I almost took his arm as he hobbled toward the bench. I would have if I hadn't thought he'd be offended by my offer to help.
"There, that's better,"
he said after lowering himself. He patted the spot on the other side of the bench. As I sat, He pulled out a handkerchief and dabbed his face with it.
Now, look. I'm going to be honest with you. That was a heck of a thing in there, he said. I'm not sure I've ever had a 5-day hearing that was so... combative is the word that comes to mind. If you're feeling a little woozy, I don't blame you. I do too.
Thank you, I said. And I meant it.
I'm sorry I couldn't keep that nonsense about the confidential informant out of evidence, he said,
shaking his head as he returned his handkerchief to his pocket. I appreciate that you tried, I said. Who is that confidential informant anyway? Do we have any way of figuring that out?
We might, he said.
How?
Well, I've been thinking about that, and some fancy lawyering from yours truly just might be in order. The search warrant is a public record, so that's not the issue. The problem is, in the warrant, they list the confidential informant by number, not name. The only way we can unmask him, so to speak, is to challenge the warrant itself.
You can do that?
Oh, sure. This would be connected to your criminal case, so it happens over in circuit court. I can make a motion to have the warrant suppressed on the grounds that the confidential informant was lying to the sheriff's office. The judge will eventually tell them to produce their CI. At that point, we'll have what's known as a motion hearing. Depending on how it goes, that might be your whole case right there.
What do you mean?
Once I get that fellow up on the stand, I'm hoping I can trip him up and catch him in a lie. Maybe more than one. Once the judge sees that the confidential informant isn't on the up and up, he'll have no choice but to toss the warrant. If the government loses the warrant, all the evidence found as a result of that warrant is known as fruit from a poisoned tree. It's inadmissible.
Inadmissible as in
gone, he said. And without any evidence, they don't have any case. The prosecutor would have to drop the charges.
I took in a deep breath. It was tempting to listen to Mr. Honeywell's strategy. Simple, straightforward, and seemingly so possible, and get hopeful. But hadn't I already learned how dangerous that emotion could be? I looked up at the tree hanging over us. Its buds were just about to burst, heavy enough that they were bending the branches. It was one of those portents of spring, of rebirth. It made me think of the tulips in front of my house. They had once filled me with optimism, too. And look how that turned out. You really think that's going to work? I asked.
We won't know until we try.
We. There I was, overvaluing pronouns again. But to hear the first person plural come out of his mouth was heartening. And as I looked at him, my wrinkled champion, I wondered what it was that had come over him. Until recently, he had been as skeptical of me as everyone else. Something had clearly changed his thinking. Mr. Honeywell, thank you, but I guess I'm curious. Why are you helping me like this? The question seemed to amuse him.
Miss Barrick, I know I might not look like much, but I am your lawyer.
No, I know that, but I'm not naive. The court barely pays you anything for this, and you've probably had a million clients singing the same song as me about how innocent they are, and you can't possibly believe them. I know you probably didn't believe me at first, but in court just now, you were acting, I don't know, differently.
He chuckled softly. that's hard to answer.
Please try. We sat in silence for a little while as he composed an answer. When he finally began, it was in a voice that was as slow and marble-mouthed as ever, but also somehow deeper and sadder.
Miss Barrack, I've been doing this a long time. Maybe not always well, and certainly not lucratively, but a long time nevertheless. When you sit where I've sat for 40 years, you realize no one is purely bad and no one is purely good. We're all somewhere in the middle, and sometimes it's just a question of what position the world puts us in that determines which side of the courtroom we sit on. Do you follow me so far?
Sure.
I don't kid myself about who my clients are. They've probably done bad things, you're right. But they're not really bad people, much as some folks in the legal system might like to view them that way. It's my job to represent them all the same. I've got to make sure the courts treat them fairly, of course. And maybe, if I'm having a good day, I can even get the courts to see my clients the way I do. As that mix of good and bad that we all are. That's probably the best I can do for most of them. And I can sleep okay at night knowing I've tried my best.
He paused and sighed heavily.
But then, every once in a while, a client comes along.
Mr. Honeywell was now the one looking up at the tree.
When I saw you in court this morning, I was really struck by...
He was struggling with the words, almost choking on them.
Well, you remind me of someone, put it that way. Seeing you in that dress... Maybe I understood who you really were for the first time.
What do you mean? I asked.
I see you, Miss Barrack,
he said cryptically.
I see you.
I don't understand.
And I don't think I can explain it, he said. It doesn't matter anyway.
He lifted himself slowly from the bench. To my astonishment, he had tears in his eyes. He pulled out his handkerchief again and blotted his face.
I see you, Miss Barrack,
he said one last time.
And to be perfectly honest, it scares me to death.
What do you mean? I asked. Mr. Honeywell, wait! But he was already limping away. Chapter 31. There were 4 vehicles in the convoy pointed toward Warren Plotz's residence, 3 Fords bearing the mustard yellow and brown insignia of the Augusta County Sheriff's Office, and a Subaru that was unmarked, save for the Coexist sticker on the back bumper. They made for a strange quartet. Though that was fitting. This was not a normal occasion for Amy Kay, the driver of the Subaru. Arrests were something she usually only experienced on paper. But she wasn't going to miss this one. This was 3 years and an enormous pile of personal hours in the making. The deputies, who might normally have balked at having a lawyer watching over them while they did their jobs, didn't protest when Amy said she wanted to join them. This was her bust. Even if she wasn't going to be the one laying the cuffs on Plotz, they all knew she had earned this. Beyond the self-satisfaction she was savoring as they turned into Plotz's neighborhood, there was also a heaping measure of retribution she felt on behalf of the victims. She had met with nearly every one of them, many of them more than once.
She had seen the pain in their eyes as they recounted the most harrowing experience of their lives. She wanted to be able to share this moment with all of them. What exactly their tormentor had looked like when he realized that he had been caught, that he was never going to spend another moment of his life as a free man, that one of his victims had bested him. Amy hoped he cried or blubbered or begged for forgiveness. After all the tears the women had spilled because of him, that would be poetic justice. Plotz's house was in a new subdivision, a place where the landscaping was twiggy and the driveways weren't yet cracked. People there weren't used to seeing a phalanx of sheriff's cars making quick time through the quiet streets. The deputies pulled into Plotz's driveway, blocking in a Dodge Ram 2500, whose presence suggested the owner was at home, perhaps even watching from inside. It was no matter. They weren't going for stealth here. They wanted a show of force. There were six deputies, each wearing a bulletproof vest. Records indicated Plotz had a concealed carry permit. They weren't taking chances. Two deputies went around back, in case Plotz tried to run. The other four came up the front steps. Amy wasn't very far behind. She felt like she carried the emotional authority of the victims with her. The deputies did not bother knocking. Plotz had certainly never extended such courtesy to his victims. They took down his front door with a small battering ram. A sergeant led the way inside.
"Police! Warren Plotz, this is the Augusta County Sheriff's Office, and we have a warrant for your arrest," he shouted. "Do not try to resist. We have you surrounded."
With their service weapons raised, the other deputies poured in behind him, then fanned out across the first floor, going room by room with smooth efficiency. He wasn't there. The deputies reassembled at the bottom of the carpeted steps and moved quietly up them. The sergeant again led the way. Pausing at the door to the master bedroom, he made eye contact with each of his subordinates, making sure they were ready. It was possible Plotz, now aware of their presence, was holed up in his bedroom, ready to make his last stand. All four deputies now had their guns unholstered. It wouldn't last long if Plotz tried to resist. But was this how Plotz wanted to go out? Suicide by cop? Amy retreated down the stairs by two treads, but was still peering around the corner. The sergeant mouthed a 1, 2, then opened the door on 3. The room was tomb dark, unnaturally so for 3 o'clock on a sunny March afternoon. From what little light made it in from the hallway, Amy could see a shade that entirely wrapped the window it enclosed, blocking any attempt by the sun to penetrate the room. The deputies had seemingly disappeared into the gloom. Then,
"Warren Plotz, do not move. You are under arrest."
It was the sergeant. One of the deputies flipped on a light switch. Amy could now see one of the deputies had a gun aimed at Plotz, who was sitting up on a king-size bed in the middle of the room, appropriately astonished at having been woken up by four armed men. His upper half was bare. His lower half was still wrapped in a tangle of blankets.
"What the—"
Plotz began, then finished the phrase with a vulgar, intransitive verb. Amy walked into the room as Plotz clawed at his ears and removed two hunks of wax from them. Earplugs. He had been wearing earplugs. That's why he hadn't heard the officers breaking down the front door or coming in. He was a man who slept most of the day, exhausted as he was from his nocturnal activities. The moment Plotz saw Amy, he recoiled a little.
"Oh, what the—"
he said again, ending with the same curse.
"Is this because of that bitch Melanie Barrick? What did that cunt say about me? Whatever she said, it was a lie. She's a lying bitch."
"Mr. Plotz, turn around and lie on your stomach," the sergeant ordered.
But Plotz wasn't hearing it. He was pointing at Amy, his sleep-lined face red with rage.
Melanie Barrick is a lying bitch! She's a lying bitch! She's had it out for me for a long time. I fired her last week for being a scumbag drug dealer. She's nothing more than a disgruntled ex-employee. Anything she says about me is a lie. If you arrest me, I'll sue you. I'll sue the crap out of all of you.
Shut up, Plotz, the sergeant said. Turn over and lie on your stomach now, or we're going to do this the hard way.
Plotz offered a few more choice opinions about Melanie Barrick before complying with the order. The sergeant brought Plotz's wrists together, then clamped on a set of black handcuffs.
There we go, the sergeant said. Let's get this asshole out of here.
If the wait for fingerprint results was slow before, it was now interminable. This time, the delay was more human than technical. Plots had to be brought before the magistrate, then processed. The bureaucracy would not be rushed. At some point, Plotz must have been allowed to use a phone. His wife, father, and lawyer were now down at the sheriff's office, filling the reception area with their anxious energy. Maybe they knew, or suspected. Especially the woman. Plotz was a patient hunter who scoped out his victims thoroughly before he pounced. It was no accident the women he attacked had been alone. How could the wife not at least wonder where her husband disappeared to night after night? Still, Amy felt sympathy for them. They were about to become two more of Warren Plotz's victims, their lives inalterably changed by their association with the worst serial rapist the Shenandoah Valley had ever known. They would forever be known as the wife of, the father of. Once she retreated from the dispatcher's area, Amy was mostly making a conscious effort not to pester Deputy Justin Herzog for the fingerprint results. Everything would happen in due time. Amy hoped to have a confession by dinner. She wondered if he'd start with Lily Pritchett, and then slowly admit to the rest of them after they confronted him with DNA matches, or if he'd give up the whole thing right away. One thing was for sure. She planned to start notifying the victims that night. Lily first, then Daphne Hasper. Then maybe Melanie Barrick. It would be a shorter conversation, perhaps. But drug charges or no, Barrick deserved the same care and concern as the other women. Amy hoped to reach all of them, if possible. She was only going to be able to stall Aaron Dansby's incredible urge to leak this to the media for so long. She wanted each victim to hear it from her first, not read about it in the paper. That was about as far as her thinking had advanced when she finally got the call from Herzog. The kickboxing maestro of the fingerprint matching system was ready for her. Her calves felt turbocharged as she churned down the hallway toward that noxious-smelling room. Her nerves jangled. "Hey," she said as she entered. Herzog looked up from the screen. She walked around behind him. He had positioned the two prints side by side on the screen.
"Okay, so this is the partial for Person B," the deputy said, pointing to the one on the right. Then he shifted his finger left. "And this is the guy you just brought in."
Amy narrowed her eyes at the images. There was something off about them, but she couldn't quite place it. While she had seen a lot of fingerprint results in her time, she couldn't read them quickly. Herzog could. And he already had.
"These are two different people," he said. "Sorry."
Amy could practically feel the blood draining from her face. It took a moment for her to even summon words.
Are you sure you didn't, I don't know, mix them up or..."
"Sorry,"
he said again. She stared at them a little harder, and, sure enough,
there was a distinctive whirl in Person B that simply wasn't present in Warren Plotts. They weren't a match. Warren Plotts wasn't the whispering rapist. Amy had to acknowledge two painful truths. One, she had arrested the wrong man. And two, she was back to where she had been 2 weeks ago. Nowhere. Chapter 32. The baby liked to face out. That's all there was to it. That was the whole trick. That, by God, was everything. Try to cuddle the little guy against your chest or shoulder, and you might as well have been thrusting him against hot coals. He'd wail himself crimson, squirming and bucking the whole time. But then turn him around, and it was like flipping a switch. Instant calm. Happy baby. Happy foster mother. And yes, it took her about 5 days to discover this. 5 hellishly long days, during which time she seriously considered suicide, gouging her eardrums with a screwdriver, and myriad other solutions that felt like they would be less painful than listening to the kid cry anymore. Now, he was as contented as any baby could be. Sure, he had needs. He cried some. He fussed when he was tired. But for the most part, all she had to do was feed him, change him, and give him a nice view until he fell asleep again. "You just want to see the world, that's all," she told him. "I bet you're going to be a traveler when you grow up." They took walks around the neighborhood, because she discovered facing him outward and being outside made the baby even happier. At one point, one of the neighbors had asked to hold him. And, of course, the moment he was turned inward, like people did when they held a baby, he started howling. It was almost comical. Or at least it was now that she knew the secret. "Oh," she explained, "he's an outward-facing baby." After that simple epiphany, order was restored to the household. She was able to get some basic cleaning done, as long as she did it with one hand and held the baby in a way that allowed him to see what was going on. She could even vacuum. The boy seemed fascinated by the machine. So it was a relatively calm, relatively clean, relatively stable household when her husband returned from work one night. He walked in to find his wife dancing around the room with the baby, whose back was against her front in a baby Bjorn, allowing him to enjoy the scenery as she spun slowly around. "You two certainly seem to be getting along well," he said, smiling warmly. She stopped in mid-twirl. "You know, I've been thinking. Should we change his name?"
"To what?"
"I don't know. I think he should be named after his daddy, don't you think?" The man smiled even more broadly. "Let's do it tomorrow," she said. "I downloaded some boilerplate name change documents online while he was napping. We can go down to the courthouse and file the papers."
"Slow down," the man said. "We need the adoption to go through first."
"I know, but you said that was just a matter of time."
"It is. It is."
"You keep saying that. But what if Melanie's rights aren't terminated?" Melanie. Always, that's how the baby's mother was referred to in the household. Melanie. As if they knew her. As if they were the best of friends. The woman continued. Then her voice faltered. I can't even bear the thought of losing him." She wrapped her arms around the baby and kissed him protectively on top of the head.
"That's not going to happen," the man said firmly. "I keep telling you, I'm on it."
Chapter 33. Mindful of Judge Stone's order to get a job and of my fast emptying bank account, I started looking for employment first thing Wednesday morning. I set my expectations low, aware of my obvious liabilities. I didn't bother with anything white-collar. The people who hired at those kind of places read newspapers and did Google searches. My first stop was Starbucks. Had Marcus still been the manager, becoming reemployed there would have been as easy as asking him to fill my name in on the schedule. But it turned out Marcus was now two managers removed from the current one and had basically been erased from the institutional memory of the Stanton Starbucks. I didn't know any of the people who were working the counter when I went in. The new manager curtly told me they weren't hiring at the moment. He took my number in case things changed, but we both knew he'd lose it as soon as I was out the door. This set me off on a long and frustrating tour through Stanton. The manager at Chili's stared at me hard enough that I could tell she recognized me from the newspaper. Firehouse Subs was adding to its management team but required a background check. Walmart wasn't hiring. Neither was Staples. Nor anything at the down-on-its-luck Stanton Mall. Lowe's wanted to know if I had any home improvement experience and didn't seem to act as if painting my living room qualified. The rest of the big-box stores I drove past were, likewise, busts. Martin's, one of the local grocery stores, was looking for a produce manager, and the woman there seemed interested when I described my experience on the other end of the supply chain and my detailed knowledge about spoilage rates. Then she asked if she could call Diamond Trucking for a reference. And on it went. There were at least 10 different places that had me fill out applications, but I received only vague promises about whether or when I'd hear back. My second-to-last stop was Mattress Marketplace. Maybe they'd be trying to fill Ben's position. As I drove there, I tried to fend off the strong sense of loss gripping me by thinking how this could be a sign the universe had some sense of fairness. Ben had run out at the lowest point in my life, and it hurt like hell, but at least he would also be leaving me his job. The manager smiled at me nicely, then said he was sorry, but they had already found someone. It was getting late in the workday at that point, and I might have broken down on him a little bit. In his attempts to console me, he told me he heard Waffle House was hiring. I slid into the place around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, well after the lunch rush, but before dinner got going. The woman at the counter directed me to the back, where I discovered a harried-looking manager in a dreary, grease-stained office. She looked at me like she had given up on pretty much everything long ago, and that she was surprised to still be here. Here being not just the restaurant, but the planet. Her first question was whether I had any service experience. I told her about my 2 years at Starbucks. She asked if I was okay not having a regular shift. They had holes in the schedule all over the place. I said that was fine. Until I got Alex back, I could work whenever she needed me. The job paid $2.13 an hour, plus tips, which I had to report down to the penny. If, at the end of a pay cycle, my tips didn't add up to at least $7.25 an hour, Virginia's sad concept of a minimum wage, Waffle House would make up the difference. I asked the manager how often that would happen. "I guess you'll find out, honey," was her answer. "You want to work or not?" Judge Stone said I had to get a job. He didn't say it had to be a good one. Chapter 34. Amy Kay had two headaches that Thursday morning. The first could be attributed to Warren Plotz. She had spent most of the day Wednesday cleaning up that mess. The heir of the Diamond Trucking Empire wasn't some scared kid who was just grateful to be cut loose. He had his indignation, and he wielded it with a heavy hand, taking the minor flesh wound that was being wrongly accused of a crime for a few hours and turning it into a gaping psychological hemorrhage. He eventually agreed to be placated by a letter of apology from the Commonwealth's attorney, but even that turned into a fecal tempest, with the election-minded Commonwealth's attorney refusing to sign anything that might be leaked to the media. In the end, Plotz grudgingly accepted a letter signed by Chief Deputy Commonwealth's Attorney Amy Kay, accompanied by an in-person apology. Somewhere in the midst of that back and forth, Amy got the additional punch in the mouth that was the phone call from Chap Burleson, the lab director in Roanoke. Unsurprisingly, the DNA sample on the soda can did not match the DNA from the other sexual assaults. Burleson was civil about it, but there was a why-did-you-waste-my-time undertone to his words. All the while, Amy stewed in her chief mistake. She had allowed herself to become overly emotional, and therefore overzealous. That had led her to ignore policies and procedures that had been put in place for just this reason, to prevent one person's passion from having undue influence on what was supposed to be a dispassionate process. By Wednesday night, at which point Amy had felt like a puppy whose nose had been rubbed in her mistakes altogether too much, she finally went and did what she should have done all along. Go to the restaurant where her husband worked, get slowly and thoroughly inebriated on whiskey, and then let him take her home and tuck her into bed. Which had all seemed like a fine, wonderful idea, until she had to wake up Thursday morning. So that was the first headache. The second came shortly after she was alerted that an appeal had been filed on behalf of one Demetrius Mookie Myers. The appeal itself was no surprise. Myers had a new lawyer who had filed notice a month earlier. She hadn't been expecting trouble. Maybe a claim for ineffective assistance of counsel or some kind of quibble with the jury instructions, neither of which would really involve her. Most criminal appeals were basically legal spaghetti, flung against the walls of the Court of Appeals in Richmond in the hopes they might stick. But to Amy's surprise, this particular appeal was gooey enough to do just that. One of the witnesses against Myers had been an elderly neighbor who bravely testified she had repeatedly seen Myers selling cocaine in a small alley behind their apartment building. She had come forward against Myers because she was tired of all the undesirables Myers's activities were attracting to her home. According to the petition, the witness, who was afraid of Myers's remaining foot soldiers, had been paid $5,000 out of a victim witness fund to relocate out of the county. There was nothing illegal about that, of course. The sheriff's office did it all the time. Except, this small fact had never been introduced at trial, and Myers's new lawyer was pointing out, rightly, unfortunately, that the jury should have heard about it, the argument being that the payment might have helped motivate her testimony. Depending on how profound a slip the appellate judge deemed it to be, it could result in a new trial for Myers. If it was true, and there was one way to quickly find out. Amy pulled out her phone, hoping this was one of the times Sheriff Jason Powers could be quickly found. Two rings later, she heard, "Hello? Hey, Jason, it's Amy Kay. How's it going?" "Not good. I'm looking at the appeal in the Mookie Myers case." "Yeah? And?" "You remember that nice little old lady who brought the case to you guys?"
"Yeah."
"Did you pay her $5,000 to help her move out of that apartment building and into a new place?"
"Uh-huh. She was doing that whole I'm on a fixed income thing.
She said she wouldn't testify until we got her out of there. Why?
Don't you think you could have, I don't know, told me about that?
We didn't? Powers asked.
Amy let out a long sigh and shook her throbbing head. 2 hours later, having swallowed some aspirin and drank as much water as she could force down her throat, Amy was walking through the glass front doors at the Augusta County Sheriff's Office. She was already thinking about her evidence and how she'd have to present it all over again. Lieutenant Camp had been the lead investigator, and obviously he wouldn't give her trouble about testifying a second time. He had only himself to blame for not telling Amy about the payout. Then there was the old lady. Amy wanted Kemp to contact her to make sure she hadn't moved again. That left the drugs and the guns. The latter were still in existence. They had been confiscated and were waiting to be melted down, something the sheriff's office did once a year, in December. The former should have been handled already. After the trial, it's the duty of the sheriff's office investigator to destroy the drugs, then certify to a judge he has done so. But Amy couldn't find the certification in the file. That meant the drugs were still in the evidence lockup, which was a small break in Amy's favor. In larger drug cases like this one, she liked to put the product in front of the jury to make the crime more concrete. Look here, see this? This is what the menace looks like. This is the sickness this man was spreading throughout our community. Now she just needed to make sure the drugs weren't scheduled to be destroyed, say, today. Amy could have done all this with a phone call, but it was a delicate thing, telling the lead investigator he had botched a detail like this, and she valued her relationship with Lieutenant Kemp enough to do it in person. She found the lieutenant in his small office just off the detective's bullpen. Skip Kemp had always reminded her of an introverted high school English teacher in some way she couldn't quite place. Maybe it was his unassuming air, or that she had once caught him reading an Aldous Huxley novel over lunch. As soon as Kemp saw Amy, he slumped his shoulders and hung his head.
"I am so, so sorry," he said. "Sheriff just reamed me out pretty good. But if you want to take a turn, I fully deserve it."
"It's okay," Amy said.
"No one bats a thousand."
"No, it's really not okay. As soon as Sheriff told me, I just couldn't believe I bungled something so basic."
"Seriously, don't beat yourself up too much," Amy said. "It's possible the judge will let us off the hook and decide this disclosure wouldn't have changed the outcome. And look, if there is a new trial, our case will be every bit as solid the second time as it was the first, okay?"
"Yeah, I know. It's just, I feel like we spent too much time landing this fish to throw it back like this."
"We'll land him again. Don't worry," Amy said.
"Speaking of which, I noticed there wasn't anything in the file about the drugs being destroyed. Have you not done that yet?"
If it was at all possible, Kemp shrunk even further.
"You're not going to like this," he said.
Amy just cocked her head.
"A few weeks after the trial, I was collecting all my notes and everything, getting ready to put them in the morgue. That's usually when I get rid of the drugs, right? Then I do that little write-up for the judge and sign my name in blood that I've done it and all that. But when I went back to evidence and started looking for them, they were sort of gone."
"Gone?" Amy said. "What do you mean, gone?"
"I don't know what to tell you. The sergeant and I literally emptied the entire lockup and went through every item piece by piece. The drugs weren't there."
"So where are they?"
Kemp just spread his hands wide. "I wish I could tell you, but I can't even make something up. According to the chain of custody sheet, they're still in there."
"When were you planning on telling me about this?" To be perfectly honest, I was hoping they'd either turn up or we'd figure out which one of our guys stole them so we could flay him alive and then put the stuff back before anyone outside the department knew it was gone. Amy's headache, which had